Okay, so this is Bio 241, and it's Tuesday evening, August 19th, and we're just starting class, the first lecture, and I'm showing you how to log on to Blackboard, and then we're going to look at the syllabus in just a little bit. So you have to have a username and password. Who knows what your username is?
Student number.
Yeah, it's just your student number. Followed, not followed by, but preceded by that funny little symbol, which is the ampersand. All right, so then I'm going to put in my username. Okay, my username is this one. Yeah, that's it. Okay, and then your password, I think the password that you use for WebStar should work. It may or may not. If it doesn't work, then I can change it for you. I can't find out what it is, but I can make it something else, and then you can go back in and change it for whatever you like. All right, and then hit enter, and that should take you to your Blackboard site. And you're going to see, you might be taking some other classes that have content on Blackboard, but you probably won't be taking all these classes this semester. You might have just me in this class, or you might have two classes or three classes. All right, but it's going to, in this one, it's going to be what, general human physiology of some kind or another. And you click on that, and let's see, which one looks good? Probably this one looks good, this one looks good. Let's see what we got right here. Okay. I don't have any announcements in there, but maybe tomorrow or certainly by the end of the week, I'll send everybody an email and tell you that some assignments are ready or something like that. So when you log into Blackboard, not only are you checking that you know your student number and your password, but also make sure that in Blackboard you put a correct email address. And so in the personal information area someplace, there's a personal information area, put in a correct email address. If there's one in WebStar, that should carry over as well, but just double check. Maybe, I don't know if you have a control panel button as a student. Okay, but there should be a personal information area someplace. Does anybody see it anywhere?
I think it's under tools.
Tools? Ah, okay, tools, communication, course tools, thank you. Address, personal information. Ah, very good. Yeah, so you can double check your email address to make sure that it's valid. And don't forget those email addresses have to be exactly literal, just like where you want it to go. Otherwise, it will get bonked out. Okay, course information. Here's the syllabus. And you can open it up, and it will show in this frame right over here, and you'll have the left-hand frame available to you. But you probably just want to download this file to your computer. Right, and does anybody know what kind of file that is? By just looking at the title, look at the suffix. It's a .doc, which is a Microsoft Word file. Right, so you'll need a Microsoft Word program to open it up, or some program that works with Microsoft Word. If you don't, I can send you a link if I don't have it on here already, where you can get a free viewer to Microsoft Word documents. All right, so to download that to the computer, usually when you execute a link, so you notice the cursor changing from an arrow to a little hand. That means that it's just not some type on that web page, but it's actually an executable statement. Usually you click the right-hand mouse button. Okay, but in this particular case, if you want to download it, use the right-hand mouse button. Okay, if you use the right-hand mouse button, you're going to get this menu. And just save the target as someplace on your computer. So now I click on that. It's downloading it, and that's the file name. And where should we put it? Well, we can put it on the desktop, but maybe let's put it in my folder here someplace. That's good. Say save. And then it will ask you if you want to open it, and we'll say sure. Okay. So here is what I just handed out for you. Ah, that's the wrong one. Oh, because I opened up the wrong section. Okay, I understand. Let's do this. I opened up the wrong CRN number. Let's see if I can find who this is. Here. 868. This is the Tuesday, Thursday section. You won't have a choice of all those courses, okay? You're just going to have your course. All right, so course information, syllabus. If I want to download this, what mouse button do I use? The right-hand mouse button. Click, save target as, good. That looks good. We'll say saved, and hopefully then open. Did I get the Tuesday, Thursday one? Ah, very good. Okay, for fall. On this web page right here, this first bit of information, just my contact information, telephone number, my office, and this website. This is where I'm going to put the lectures, but right now there really isn't anything interesting for you there because I use Blackboard for all the content in this class. My office hours, notice that on Monday, Wednesday, I am in my office on this floor in the faculty office area, but on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I'm in anatomy lab, so I just hold an open anatomy lab there. So if you're taking anatomy this semester, you could come in and look at some brains and eyeballs. So if you just want to go in there and refresh your information, you're welcome to do that too. All right, here's a textbook that we're using, Human Physiology by Fox, edition number 10. This is what it looks like for you, just like this. All right, so that's probably pretty important because there's questions at the end of the chapter that I tell you that I want you to know about, because sometimes I lift those questions, put them right on the test for you. There are exam figures. There are figures in the textbook that I like. Sometimes I photocopy those exam figures, put those directly in the test, and you have to label them. And those figures aren't necessarily just anatomy figures, but they're physiology figures as well. The lab manual I don't have with me. It's a green-colored book, soft-bound book. Didn't bring it. Okay, you probably don't exactly need it tonight because we have some handouts, but I see one there. It's called Integrate by Stephanie Spooner, who teaches this class here. And I think we're going to provide you with all of the... That's it right there. Perfect. The other book that you will need for lab is called Physio EX. It might be hard to get, so I think we're making photocopies for everybody in lab, so you don't have to buy that. And it comes with a CD with the simulation programs, and those are all loaded in the computer. So when you walk into lab tonight, you'll notice that there's computers all over the place in lab. Which reminds me of one thing before I forget, but don't forget your question, okay? Since there are computers everywhere in lab, make sure you don't bring any drinks into lab, because we don't want any Coca-Cola, coffee, anything going into the keyboards or the computers, because it's just really difficult to get them all set up to work with the other physiologic equipment that we have to hook up to them. Right, so no food or drink in the labs. Yeah?
In the bookstore, they sell the physiology books brand new in the disc.
Don't need the disc. Don't need the disc. We're going to change that for spring semester. Yeah. Okay. Now, the Physio EX does come with a program, a disc, but we're going to provide that for you. So that's why I have that to be determined right here. You also need a Cypress College picture ID. I'm going to need that for your tests. And if you ever go to the library to check out material, you need a Cypress College picture ID as well. A driver's license won't work. And for the learning center, right? So if you go over there and you think you have plenty of IDs on you, and if it's not a Cypress College picture ID, don't get mad at the librarian, okay? Because they're just trying to do their job. Okay. And so it will take you probably 10 minutes, 5 minutes to get a Cypress College picture ID and $2.50 at the student center, student activities office. It's easy to do. Email account, I say, is optional, but it would be really silly of you not to have one, because then I can't communicate with you. And then here are some links for logging on to your gateway and then Blackboard right here. Any questions on required materials? Yeah. That's a really good question, and I don't have an answer for you. I don't know if it works. You know, I got a feeling it does. It will work for tests, okay? That will work fine for me, but for checking, and I got a feeling it will work for the library, but I'm not certain. If the library is still open tonight, when you go home, you might want to just stop in and see, okay? And I think it works at the Long Beach, Cal State Long Beach as well. I'm not sure. So maybe. Yeah, but that's different than LRRC. LRRC is pretty sticky about that. Yeah. Okay. So the other thing about tests in here, you need a Scantron and a pencil, and more importantly, a good eraser. So before you take a test, I'll mention this before you take a test again. Get your pencil out, not right now, but before you take a test. Make a mark on a clean piece of paper, then take your good eraser out and erase it. If it smudges that line, throw the eraser away and go buy another new one, a good one, right? Because if you smudge up your Scantron, you're not going to get credit for the correct work that you put on the Scantron. Fortunately, you'll have opportunity to review your tests in here, but you're going to be taking a lot of tests, board exams, that you never get the Scantrons back. And if you make those same kind of errors on a board exam, then you're going to have to pay $500 to take the board exam over again, even though you passed it the first time. So just really learn how to work with a Scantron. Okay, it's a little tough, but once you get the hang of it, it's not bad. Okay? Mm-hmm. I believe it's an 884 ES. I think you're going to need 5 because we have 5 tests in here. Okay, I'll mention that. Prerequisites for this class, Bio 230 or 231, that's anatomy, or the combined A&P class, 210. And chemistry is not a mandatory class that you have to take, but it's highly recommended. And I've recommended that students take chemistry, and lots of students that I give that recommendation to have taken chemistry, and none of them have ever come back to me and said that it was a waste of time. They said that it was crucial for them to do well in physiology. Okay, so that's just something to consider. But don't even think about taking this class if you're not through with anatomy. Okay, make sure that you can get a decent grade in anatomy. Okay, attendance, you got to come. If you miss 1 week of class and then a little bit of something else, then I have to drop you, like 2 lectures and a lab, then that's it. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet every day. So here is the sign-in sheet. Make sure you sign in. That is your receipt that you've come to class. So if for some reason I think you've missed class, and unfortunately maybe I drop you, you can say, well, let's take a look at the roll call. And if your name is on the roll call, then I have to say, oops, sorry. Okay, so make sure you sign. And probably you have to do the same thing in lab, too. Grading, 75% of your...
That's for today, correct?
Every day.
We're going to do it every day?
Yeah, we're going to do it every day, as long as I can remember to do that. Okay. Usually, you know, a small class like this, I probably pretty much would know who's in class and not in class. But in a big lecture hall where I have 90 students or 120 students, there's no way. And so I'm just trying to treat all the students and all the classes the same way. And the same thing for the picture ID. I probably don't need all of you to bring your picture ID. But since I'm teaching online classes and on-campus classes, I just make the requirements for everybody the same. Okay. So for instance, if one class, all the students had to wear gloves for whatever reason, then I would make you wear gloves in class too, just so that I had to treat everybody the same. Okay. But luckily we're not doing that. Okay, so 75% of your grade is going to come from the lecture part, 25% from laboratory. And lab quizzes, you're going to have a lab quiz every week, and that's going to count for about 160 points. So you might get 16 quizzes, 10 points each. That's where that 160 comes from. If you have more or less, those quizzes will be scaled to where if you get 100% on all the quizzes, you get 160 points. If you get 50% on all the quizzes, then you get, what, 80 points. So it will be scaled accordingly as to how many quizzes you have. 5 lecture tests, 100 points each, so that's 500. So the total points is 660. And then it's just a straight 90, 80, 70, and it drops down a little bit to 55, right? A difference between a D and an F. During tests in here, we have to just do individual efforts, so please no looking around the room, and it's a closed book. Don't open up a book during the test or lecture notes or anything like that. Okay, so just what you have in your own mind is best, and you can look at the honesty policy in the Cypress College schedule of classes. I think I'm going to have you read all of this other stuff. Okay, if you have any questions, make sure you ask me about anything pertinent to this class. Here is a little blurb about audio recording. So if for some reason you don't want me to record in class, the microphone is right here by my voice, so it can pick me up very well, but it can't hear people that are in the room. So if it's a real important question, ask me to repeat the question because you won't hear it on the recording. So that also means, though, that if you ask a question, nobody will be able to hear your voice and therefore won't be able to recognize you because it just won't get picked up on this microphone. Okay, so that's it's really not an important issue, but I have to mention it anyway. Here's the class schedule. But what kind of class schedule is this? It's tentative, that's right. It could change during the semester. And all classes are different, so we'll get ahead of schedule, we'll get behind schedule, and you have to come to class to make sure that you know exactly what the schedule is, right? And so when we look at that, we see different columns like week and date, topic, text reading, and the score that you have on a particular test. So if we, what's the first column again?
Week.
How many weeks are we in class for? It looks like 17, yeah. Okay, so what's the date of the last exam? That's the second column over. How do you read that? December 11th is your last exam. And the last exam is just a regular test, even though it's given during finals week. It's not cumulative. And it's going to be over chapters that are in parentheses here, 16, 17, 18, and 20, tentatively, right? And what's the date of the first exam? September 11th. Oh, I didn't notice that little symmetry right there. December 11th, September 11th. Okay, and what chapters are on the first test? 1, 2, 3, and then we skip to 6, right? Okay, so those are the chapters on that first test. So that's how you read this, and then when you get a score for this exam, just put it in this column over here, and it's going to be out of 100 points. So you should be able to tell exactly what kind of grade. If I had to give you a grade on a particular day, just add up your points, figure out the percentage, and you could then tell exactly where you are in this class at any particular time. Okay, so that's pretty easy to do. So, for instance, on August 19th, which is today, what are we going to cover? Introduction and homeostasis, right? So it's pretty easy to look at this class schedule and figure out what's going on with this. And then I think the last page, do I have the lab schedule? Yeah, here's a tentative lab schedule. You're going to have a really nice lecture on homeostasis today in lab. I'll cover some of those topics today, but it'll be reinforced a lot more in lab today. And then next time, some thermodynamics, and then we do some membranes and protein chemistry, whole animal metabolism. Okay, so that's the schedule for lab. And this is probably not as tentative as the lecture schedule. Last day to drop. What's the last day to drop? You know what? I think I have it wrong on the schedule. I think it should be November 19th is the last day to drop. Ah, we should double check that. See, this italic should be with this date up over here. And this renal physiology should be down over here. So double check the schedule of classes. But I believe it's, oh wait, I have a thing right here. No. Deadline to drop with a W is November 22nd. I wonder if that's right. It's different than the course catalog. Okay. All right, well, as that date approaches, we'll have to make sure we know exactly what it is. All right. One more thing that I want you to do in this class, and this is a little bit of experimentation on you. Sorry. Okay, so everybody got the slides for today? I'll put some extras away. Actually, we're going to do a lot of experiments with you today. But here's the one that we're going to do right now. So let's close the syllabus out unless somebody has a question. Anybody have a question on syllabus? No? Okay. Okay, weekly study plan. So if you want to download this to your computer, you put the cursor over this link and do what? Right-hand mouse button, right-click, save target as. And it's going to go in my folder. That's fine. Say save. Right? And then we're going to say open. But before we do, what kind of file is that?
Word.
Microsoft Word document. You can see a .doc right there. So then let's open that. All right. So it says here, success is not an accident. A failure to plan is actually a plan to fail. All right, so if you don't have a plan to do well in this class, and I'm sure everybody right now would like to do really well in this class, that's why you're here, right? Especially in the evenings. So some of you might think, well, I don't really have a plan. that's okay, we'll see what happens, but what do you really have if you don't have a plan? You do have a plan. It's a plan to fail, right? So you need to have a plan. So let's get working on this plan. You need a plan. So in a college level class, the standard approach to a class, the standard theory is that for every hour in lecture that you spend, you should spend 3 hours outside of class studying for it. All right, so that means in this particular class you have 3 hours of lecture and 3 hours of lab, so that's 6 hours multiplied by 3 is how many hours per week? 18 hours. Okay, so I'm not fooling people. Now you may or may not have to study that much, I'm not sure. Depends on your background in a particular field. Maybe you've taken a lot of chemistry classes already and it's just really trivial for you to do chemistry. So that study time might change. I've had one student that was a chemist and studied a lot for the chemistry test, and it was just so easy that she didn't study for the second test, which was more physiology, and did really poor because she didn't have a background in that. So that number might have to change depending on your background when we cover certain material in the class. But this is a starting point. So this first, so I have two tables. The proposed schedule on the top and the actual schedule on the bottom. And so I filled in this schedule right here, different days of the week, Monday through Saturday, and I've broken it down into four study times like morning, afternoon, evening, and nighttime. And in morning, afternoon, and night, right here, what is the longest period of time that I have somebody studying for, proposed time? 1.5 hours. That's a really long time. Okay? So don't study for longer than 1.5 hours because we all get fatigued and our brain gets fatigued. We can study, we can apply ourselves, but our mind is not going to absorb the information. It becomes very inefficient after that. So 1.5 hours, 1 hour to 1.5 hours, take a break and then come back later in the day. That's the best way to do it. That's the most efficient way. Okay. So what I would like for you to do this week sometime is to sit down and figure out where can you get this time in your schedule to study for this class, because what would you like to do? You'd like to have fun when it comes time to take a test, right? So if you really apply yourself and put the time in, tests can be fun, right? So this will help you do that. So maybe you could study in the afternoon here. So write down your proposed time, and then as the week progresses, actually keep a log of when you're studying. And then when that week is over, compare what you actually did compared to what you think you could do. And you might have to rearrange your schedule. Maybe it's just not possible for you to study at all on Saturday. Maybe you work 12-hour shift or something, right? And you get home and you say, well, there's just no way I'm going to learn anything after working all day. So after that first week, I want you to fill this in, total up your daily totals and your weekly total, and see how it corresponds to what just the standard approach to a college-level class is. And I want you to share this with your lab instructor and me as well, okay? And especially if you're doing really poorly in the class, maybe you're not studying enough, maybe you're studying too long a period of time, or there's some conflict with us, at least we can analyze what might be going wrong with your schedule. But that maybe is not the only thing. Maybe you're studying the wrong things as well. So we'll look at all of that so that you can get a good grade. But try to work this weekly study plan, and that's on Blackboard. So how many of these are you going to have at the end of the semester? 17. Yeah, probably at least, 17, maybe a little bit less. Okay, so take one, pass it on. That's just an example for the first week, but go back to Blackboard and print them out. And if some other format is helpful for you, you know, I'll print up another Excel spreadsheet or something and make it more appropriate for all the students. Okay, so that, because a lot of times students will take a class and they really don't know how much time they really need to study for it. So this is just a first best guess. Okay? Okay. All right, so that's the weekly study plan. And be sure to share that with your instructors, because they're basically here trying to help you and get you through the class with the best grade that you can get with the time that's available for you. Okay? Okay. The other thing that I need to mention is probably some of us, I've never done this, okay, have studied for a math test starting at 11 o'clock at night, staying up to, or chemistry class, staying up to 5 o'clock in the morning, studying, cramming for a test because I didn't study during the week. Guess how that person would do on that test? Bad. They probably would fail it, right? Because even though you studied, your mind is fatigued. It's very inefficient. You put the time in, but it's just not the right quality time. Break your study periods up into small sections, and that will help you do a lot better on the tests. Okay? All right, so that's why I have those small numbers in there as well. I'll show you some more things on Blackboard next time, but I want to start lecture right now anyway, unless you have some questions. Anybody have any questions? Yeah. Yeah. It's going to, there's a study guide, and it will be clearly stated on the study guide what you need to do, and it will mostly be lecture material, but lab is supposed to support lecture. It will reinforce concepts that we are covering in lecture, so it will seem very similar. But I won't take a question out of the lab manual that you have to answer and put that on the lecture test. But you might see a question in the lab manual on a quiz or something that's in lab. So lecture tests will mostly come from lecture material. Okay. Unless for some reason I can't cover a topic in class and I ask Dr. Ogoshi to cover it in lab. But then we'll let you know exactly that you have to know that for lecture two. Okay. So we have Dr. Ogoshi for lab. Okay, so I'm closing that out. So, let's see, course documents maybe, blah, 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 blah. Lecture PowerPoints. So, for instance, we want to look at this lecture PowerPoint right here. So, the figures that are in this PowerPoint belong to the publisher of your book. I don't have copyright to that. You don't have copyright to that. So, you can download these figures, use them for your own information during the course, but don't take them and republish them on a website someplace or sell them to anybody because you don't have copyright on that material, right? And I can put it on Blackboard because it's password protected. So don't just put it on your own personal web page someplace and share it with people. All right, so if you want to download this PowerPoint presentation, how would you do that? Right-click it, right? And I think I've done that already, so I'm just going to go to that file, which is right here. And to boot it up, you just left-click it. And your computer, sometimes you do it twice, sometimes just once. All right, here's the PowerPoint presentation. So I have the first two PowerPoints ready to give you. Other than that, then you'll have to print them out yourself. And four on one page works, I think, really well for most people. And if you need to see how that's done, let me know and I'll show you how to format it before printing. Okay. Okay. So probably you all know the difference between anatomy and physiology. It's not on this slide right here, but what is physiology? It's the scientific study of the function of the human body or living system. What's anatomy? It's the scientific study of the structure, right? In this class, we're going to have to know some structures. We might study some structures, but you've probably done most of that learning already in anatomy. We're going to focus on physiology, which is the functioning of living systems. And it's how the biochemistry works and various other organs in your body, how they work to maintain life. So that's the scientific study of physiology. Pathophysiology, on the other hand, is how physiological processes are altered by disease or injury, and we're going to look at some pathophysiology in here, but that's not going to be our focus, but you should at least know what pathophysiology is. It's the study of disease processes, and we like to know about that is because we would like to prevent people from going into a disease process, or if they are in one, how to get them out, how to recover them, how to get them back, or at least manage that particular pathophysiology. A lot of times we can't cure people completely, but we can actually have them live pretty normal lives nonetheless, right? And that's actually a good thing. Okay, let me get my cursor back. There it is. Okay. All right, so since physiology and anatomy are the scientific study of something, we have to know a little bit about the scientific method. And maybe some of you know something about scientific method. I'm not really sure, but everything in this textbook has been shown to be true according to a scientific method. So you might actually be studying some pretty strange, pretty weird concepts in this particular text, stuff you've never heard about before, but it's all been shown to be true by a scientific method. So we analyze something with a scientific method if we want dependable information, if it's something that we want to depend on. And of course, in medicine, your life is going to be on the line. What kind of information would you like to have? Dependable or not dependable? Yeah, something you can count on, right? And so scientific method is a method that will give us an assurance that under certain circumstances, what we believe to be true is actually true. Okay, so that's the scientific method. So the first part, the first step in scientific method is to just look at the natural world and just observe some kind of trend that you think is repeating itself over and over and over again. And if you see a trend, we call that a hypothesis, right? If you have a belief about something, how it works in the natural world, we call that a hypothesis. And for scientific method, it has to be a testable hypothesis. It's got to be something that can actually be proven true or false with an experiment of some kind. Right, so for instance, you might have an observation when you come to school. Maybe some of you come to school or work first thing in the morning, right? And if you leave the house at 8 o'clock, it takes you an hour to get to work because there's a lot of traffic, right, if you leave at 8. But if you leave at 7:50, just 10 minutes earlier, maybe you can get to work in just 15 minutes, right? Probably some of you have noticed that, right? And that's maybe true, but that's just a guess on your part. You don't have any evidence to really support your claim, all right? So that initial guess that you have, if you just leave a little bit early, 10 minutes earlier, it saves you 45 minutes in commuting time. That's what we call an hypothesis. You really have no evidence to support your claim, but it makes sense to you, right? But since it's real important, it would be really nice to know if that's true or not. So is that a testable hypothesis, or is that not a testable hypothesis? Can you test that? Sure, you should be able to test that. How could you do that? Set your watch and leave at 10 minutes to 8 for 10 days, and then time yourself how long does it take to get to work, and write that number down. And then the next 10 times you go, leave at 8 o'clock and time yourself how long it takes to get to work, right? And then you compare the average of those two sample groups, and that should actually prove to you that your hypothesis is true or not, right? So that's a nice scientific process that you went through, right? So you conduct and analyze experiments to test hypotheses, right? So a hypothesis is just a guess. And a lot of times we misuse that statement. A lot of people say, theory. I have a theory about something. And it's really just a guess about the natural world. But there's a big difference between a hypothesis and a theory. Because a theory is the last part of the scientific method. After you come up with your best guess, and you conduct scientific experiments, and you collect your data, and you analyze the data, and you draw conclusions about whether or not the results support the hypothesis, okay, that's when a theory can be established. And in order for a theory to be realized, it's not only you that has to show that experimental data to be obtainable and correct. Other people have to drive, right, and compare their results with yours, and they should be very similar, right? So it should be able to be repeated by other people. Okay, so a theory is a general statement explaining some phenomena about the natural world that's based on a hypothesis that is backed up by scientific evidence. And so everything in your textbook is backed up by scientific evidence. Okay, that's actually very, very nice. So we're not giving you conjecture at this point. In lecture, I might give you a lot of conjecture about what might happen in medicine in the future, various kinds of drugs, different alternative therapies and things like that. But a lot of things are not backed up by scientific experiments yet. Okay, when you're testing a hypothesis, for instance, if we're going to test a particular drug to see if it has its desired effect, we need to have two different groups, an experimental group and a control group. These are patients. Okay, these are people with the exact same kind of conditions, but one group is going to get the actual pharmaceutical drug that has what we call efficacy, that will be effective, at least we think will be effective. And the other group of patients are going to get something we call a placebo. something that should have no physiologic benefit to the patient at all. Right? And so this is what we call a control group, because just by giving a patient any kind of attention, medication or otherwise, that has a tendency to improve their condition. And what we're interested in is not the interaction that a patient has with a healthcare provider, we're interested in the pharmaceutical agent. So that interaction will be canceled out by comparing experimental results with results that we get from a control group. And even more so, the person giving the drugs should not know whether they're giving the real drug or the placebo, and that person in that particular circumstance is what we call blind. They don't know what they're giving the patient. For all they know, they're giving them a drug that is going to be very helpful. So again, the interaction between the healthcare provider and the patient is exactly the same. So they're going to cancel out any kind of influence that they may have in the outcome with that particular patient. So quantitative measurements are performed blindly. So we would like to come up with some measure that is very easy to measure with some kind of analytical instrument. Like pH is a good thing to measure. We have a nice instrument that can measure pH. What's another physiologic parameter that we can measure with an instrument? Pretty easy. Temperature with a thermometer, for instance, right? Okay, blood pressure, things like that. These are nice quantitative measurements of something. Okay, if we're going to try to understand something about how well somebody's speaking and how they're speaking, that's not necessarily quantitative, all right, or affect, the affect of a patient. It's more difficult to analyze. And if we have quantitative data, then it's easy to analyze with statistics. And again, statistics is an unbiased way of looking at data. It's not going to bias one group or over another group. Okay, so when you apply statistics, inherently it's going to be a blind analysis test. Okay, so when a drug, for instance, is proposed, is hypothesized to have a beneficial effect on people, all right, first we do effectiveness and toxicity tests in tissue culture just on cells, because we're not really sure what the effects of this drug are going to be, so we're going to use a biological system to where if we harm that biological system, it's really of no consequence to us. All right, so a good place to start is just with a cell or tissue culture. All right, so these cells are alive, but they're not an organism, so we're not going to kill an organism. And if that proves to be useful, then we go to some kind of animal model, like rats or mice or something, and see if that drug has any harmful effects on rats and mice. And if they do, what do? Probably we'll stop those tests, right? We don't want to apply that same kind of pharmaceutical to human studies. All right, so this is a long process, okay, starting just with cells and then moving up into animal models. Okay, and then after that, if it's shown to work in all of those different preparations, then we go on to studies in humans. But again, we have to be very careful when we do that. There are different phases before these drugs become available to everybody for prescription. There's phase 1 through phase 4. All right, so phase 1 trials, the toxicity metabolism is tested in not sick patients or patients that are sick, but healthy individuals to see if it has any deleterious effects on healthy people. Because if it affects healthy people poorly, for sure it's going to have bad effects on somebody that's not healthy. All right, then the phase 2, effectiveness and toxicity is tested in a target population, a very small population of people that might benefit from these particular drugs. And if that helps the small population out, then the trials are expanded into phase 3 trials. So there's a widespread test of this drug with a diverse population of patients. And then after each one of these phases right here, the results are analyzed, and to see if indeed we are helping patients or hurting patients. And after phase 3 trials, even after a drug comes to market, right, the drug is tested and always analyzed for additional uses within medicine. A lot of drugs, they might be prescribed for one particular condition, but then it's found to work in another circumstance that's unpredicted, and it's really nice when that happens. So even after a drug goes to market, data is collected as long as it's an FDA-approved drug. okay, for its lifetime. So I guess I mentioned that to you to compare this process with other kinds of things that you hear about in newspapers and health food stores and things like that, namely food supplements that make claims that might help with prostate cancer or this kind of cancer and that kind of cancer. All those kinds of food supplements have never gone through this rigorous testing procedure by the FDA, okay? And so we really don't know for sure. We don't have any scientific basis to claim that any of these drugs are really going to be beneficial to patients. So it's kind of a waste of time, right? And the last thing is that even when a drug does come to market, if 10 years down the road, if we learn something bad about that drug, it can be recalled from the market. That's not true with food supplements, right? There's just no quality control. There's no bookkeeping on any of those kinds of things whatsoever. And to bring a drug to market costs about $100 million to do that, right, to go through all these tests, plus all the continuing analysis of the drug after the effect, okay, or after the fact that it's been approved by the FDA. Now, that's not to say that some herbal remedies aren't good. Many, many are very powerful drugs, but I don't think I would go to a health food store or read about a report in a magazine or a newspaper or something, but I would talk to a professional that has an education in that particular area, like somebody that has a degree in traditional Oriental medicine, okay? Because they're aware of the uses of these herbal remedies. So they don't have an FDA process, but what do they have to back up their practice in herbal medicine? Thousands of years of practice, right? So that's pretty important to know. Okay. Okay, so that's some interesting things about the scientific method, how it relates to this book, and all of the different kinds of medications and other kinds of molecules that we're going to look at in this book. Okay, so there's a lot of scientific evidence so that we can talk intelligently about most of these things that are in the book. Okay, another topic that we're going to talk about is homeostasis. And homeostasis is a term. Homeo means the same, stasis also means staying the same. So homeostasis means staying the same in kind of a general format. So right now, what's your body temperature? You all know? 98.6, okay. Is it the same as the room or different than the room temperature? You're different than the room temperature. And your pressure is different than the pressure inside this room, right? And what else? Your pH is different than the pH in this room. And the water content inside of you is different than inside the room. So you're a biological system that is regulating all these parameters, and you're much different than the environment. So homeostasis is a term that's used to talk about how all these different physiological parameters are controlled and maintained within your body so that it supports life, right? So somebody mentioned temperature. Your temperature can increase. What do we call a disease state where your temperature increases? Okay, yeah, we could say fever, but a real scientific term would be hyperthermia. Hyper meaning above, and thermia is temperature, right? So if you become hyperthermic, you're moving away from a normal temperature, and that's a disease state, and that's real easy to measure with a thermometer, but it doesn't always necessarily signal a disease state. If it goes high enough, what can it produce? More than a disease state, it can produce death, right? It can kill you. And if your temperature goes way below, say to 70 degrees, what do we call that? That is hypothermia, below normal body temperature. And if it goes to that degree, that's not a disease state. That is actually what? That's death as well, right? Okay, so homeostasis is going to maintain your temperature suitable to support life, but not just your body temperature, but your pH. Does anybody know what pH is? It's a measure of something, measure of the acidity in your body or alkalinity inside your body. And again, if that varies wildly, that is very lethal. The pH of your body is about 7.35 right now. If it were to drop within a couple seconds to 7.30 instead of 7.35, that probably would be fatal, right? Very small change. Patients over a long period of time, they can compensate. If it develops over a long period of time, maybe a couple weeks, can be alive at these lower pHs or higher pHs, but not instantaneously. Fluids, fluid balance is very important. Your water content are regulated, and many other factors of the internal environment are maintained within a range of values suitable to support life. So that's really the key word in this sentence right here, within a range. So your body temperature is not absolutely constant, 98.6. When you start to exercise, guess what happens to your body temperature? It rises a little bit, not enough to kill you, hopefully, right? But what happens as your body temperature rises? You start to sweat, and what happens to your temperature then? As that water evaporates from your body, your temperature goes back down. Okay, so homeostasis means that all of these parameters are not absolutely flat steady, but they're all moving around, and they're all compensating for each other, making sure that everything, all of these parameters, blood pressure, pH, fluid level, temperature, are within a range that's suitable to support life. So that's what homeostasis is, not a constancy, but that everything's changing a little bit all at the same time, so nothing changes drastically. Homeostasis means little changes. If there's a big change, then there's a loss in homeostasis, and that produces a disease state. All right, so that means the second statement right here, it is what? A dynamic state. It's not just a constant state, but a dynamic state where all the body's systems are working and constantly adjusting to changing internal, that's inside your body, as well as external, like if it all of a sudden dropped down to 32 degrees in here, right? That's an external change. All right, our body would compensate for that. How would our bodies compensate for if the temperature in here dropped to 32 degrees? We'd stop sweating and start shivering, right? And that would increase our body temperature. Okay. So, homeostasis. Let's see what I have on the next slide. I just want to say a couple other things about homeostasis. I kind of envision a Star Trek episode way back when. What was the spaceship in Star Trek?
Enterprise.
The Enterprise. That's right. And that was Captain Kirk. And Bones was the Dr. McCoy, Dr. McCoy. And in sick bay, that's where they put all the sick patients, right? They'd have the patient on a gurney right here, and it was really nice and sophisticated because they had a monitor at the head of the bed, and it had all these arrows. And what were the arrows doing? They were going like this, right? They weren't constant. They were pointing to different things, and you never knew what they were pointing to. But you could tell when somebody was alive because these arrows were dancing around, right? And then when somebody would die, what would happen to the arrows? They'd all flatten out and then go bloop down. But the most important thing is when somebody died, they all flattened out. They stopped moving around, right? So I think of that as a perfect graphical example of homeostasis. To me, homeostasis is a dance of parameters all fluctuating around each other, maintaining all those parameters within a range to support life. And when they flatten out, right, that's bad. What would Bones say to Captain Kirk? That was like the most important line he ever had. Oh, he's dead, Jim. Remember that? He said that thousands of times in Star Trek. Okay, so homeostasis is a dance of physiologic parameters. It's not just a constancy. So how is homeostasis maintained? It's maintained through reflexes, or something we call response loops, and you're going to look at response loops in a lab today. And a lot of response loops require signaling molecules. So let's look at some longer range reflexes and what kinds of signaling molecules are involved with that. So if we have a hormone secreting glandular cell right here that wants to influence some other cells in the body, it's going to release a chemical that we call a hormone. So this is typically what we call an endocrine gland. An endocrine gland is a hormone secreting gland. So this is an endocrine cell. And that hormone, when it's secreted from the cell, diffuses and gets picked up by a blood vessel. And once it's in the blood, where does it go? Everywhere in the body. It goes all over the place. So that's very long range. That's as long as you can go. That's as far away from the cell as you can possibly go. And it's going to go to another tissue, and we call this a target tissue or a target cell. And it can be sensitive to this hormone if it has a component on the membrane that we call a receptor. Then it will be able to listen for signals from this endocrine cell right here. It's got to have a receptor. We'll talk a lot about receptors in here. So this is a hormone. But instead of an endocrine cell, let's look at another circumstance. We can have a nerve cell right here. A nerve cell is specialized to conduct electrical activity over relatively long distances down this axon. When that electrical activity reaches the axon terminus over here, we call this a synapse. It's going to release a chemical. But this particular chemical, we don't call a hormone because it's not coming from an endocrine cell. It's coming from this neuron. And it's going to affect another neuron or some other effector cell in the neighborhood. We call this chemical a neurotransmitter. It's not a hormone. Why is this not a hormone? Because the key is a hormone has to be picked up and distributed by the circulatory system, right? So this is not a hormone. This is just a neurotransmitter. And in this third case over here, here we have a nerve cell, and it secretes a signaling molecule. And look where it goes. It goes into the circulatory system and gets distributed all over the body. So what the heck do we call that? It's something that's secreted by a nerve. We would like to call it a neurotransmitter, but it's not really a neurotransmitter because it gets picked up by the blood. What do we call something gets picked up by the blood? A hormone. So here is something that doesn't neatly fit into either neurotransmitter or neurohormone. So we got to expand our vocabulary and actually call this a neurohormone. Okay, so we're going to look at some neurohormones as well. So these are neurotransmitters, really, that get picked up by the blood and taken to distant sites to find their target tissue. And again, this target tissue has to have a receptor to be able to listen for this signal from this nerve cell right here. Okay, so in this particular case, long-range reflexes, we have hormones, neurotransmitters, or neurohormones. Some short-range reflexes. Okay, if we have some kind of local cell that is secreting a signaling molecule and it goes to a neighboring cell, we just call that a paracrine agent. It's not a hormone because it's not picked up by the cardiovascular system. And in some circumstances, a cell is going to secrete a signaling molecule that is going to diffuse and bind to a receptor on the same cell that secreted it. And that's going to change the metabolism or the activity of this cell when this agent binds to the receptor on the plasma membrane. And we call that an autocrine agent as opposed to endocrine because it doesn't have to go through the circulatory system. As soon as it's secreted, it binds to a receptor and that changes the response inside the cell. So these are just some general schemes. In this particular case, these are what? Short range or local control. We're going to look at some local control schemes later on in the class. And in terms of control mechanisms to maintain homeostasis, there are two different ways that homeostasis can be influenced. And these are through what we call feedback loops. When you get the slides from lab a little bit later, okay, there's a really nice diagram of a response loop, and you can see feedback loops, and you're going to talk some more about this in lab. But I at least want to lay some of the foundations for feedback loops. So there are two kinds of feedback. There's negative feedback and positive feedback. And negative feedback is some kind of mechanism within the body which will take a change from the normal ideal value and make that change smaller or resist that change. So this usually leads to a compensated or healthy state. So what do we mean by that? Well, let's think about temperature. So we have a stimulus that increases your body temperature, and you have some kind of feedback mechanism that's going to resist that change or even reverse it, make it go back down. That kind of feedback is what we call negative feedback. So if your body temperature goes up, some kind of negative feedback mechanism is going to make it go back down. And where is it going to go back down to? The normal temperature, right? So that produces a healthy state in somebody. So that kind of feedback we call negative feedback because the response subtracts from the stimulus. The stimulus increased body temperature, but the response is to decrease. Those two subtract from each other, so we call that negative feedback. And that produces a healthy state. That's the kind of feedback that's operating in all of us right now. There can be also positive feedback. Let's think about positive feedback for a second. That's a body mechanism by which any change from an ideal normal value is made greater. So let's think of that temperature again. If that stimulus increases your body temperature and positive feedback is working, so the stimulus is an increase in temperature, positive feedback is going to do what to your temperature? Decrease it or increase it? Increase it. And if positive feedback is still working, what's going to happen to body temperature? It's going to go higher, right? And then it's going to go higher and higher and higher and higher and higher, and then what's going to happen? And then you're going to explode in flames, right? Well, that doesn't quite happen, but you're going to die for sure, right? So positive feedback leads to a decompensated disease state, and if left to its own course, it's also going to produce death, right? So negative feedback, even though we say negative is the good kind of feedback, positive feedback produces disease. That's the wrong kind of feedback. So in medicine, we learn in most cases to stop positive feedback, to keep it from happening or to stop it from happening and get patients back into homeostasis. There's only a couple circumstances where there is positive feedback in a normal circumstance, where we want things to happen very quickly. For instance, and I have a list later on in the next couple slides, but parturition is one example of where positive feedback is very, very important. What is parturition? That is just labor and delivery, right? The birth of somebody. That's a positive feedback mechanism where what happens to the stress level of a fetus when they're in utero and they get bigger and bigger and bigger? What happens to their stress level? It increases because they get more cramped. It's not that the uterus is getting smaller. It's what? They're just getting bigger and they have less room to move around in. Okay, so their stress goes up. They secrete hormones that causes the release of oxytocin from the mother. And oxytocin is a smooth muscle stimulant, so that causes the uterus to contract. So as the stress of the fetus increases, that causes an increase in oxytocin, which causes the uterus to do what? To contract. What happens to the stress of the fetus then? It goes up, secretes more hormones, which then causes more oxytocin to be secreted, which does what to the uterus? Causes more contractions, which causes more stress, which causes more contractions, which causes more stress, and then all of a sudden, something happens. It stops, right? And then there's a baby in the outside world, right? So the positive feedback cycle then is stopped in that particular circumstance. Something has to happen drastically to stop a positive feedback cycle, but in this particular case, what, it's normal and it's good. Blood clotting is another example. Ovulation is another example. We'll look at some of these different positive feedback mechanisms. Okay, there's only a couple that are normal. Okay. So homeostasis, don't forget, is this kind of funny term, dynamic constancy. It just means that physiologic parameters will fluctuate about a what we call a set point. And what's the set point for temperature? It's a number, yeah, 98.6, right? Your temperature can go up and down, but not greatly. So we call this a normal range. And the absolute normal value is what we call the set point. And in our daily life, we might not actually be right at that set point, but that's what our body is always shooting for, to maintain what? Homeostasis, right? And homeostasis is maintained by what kind of feedback loop? Positive or negative? Negative type feedback loops, right? Because the response will subtract from the stimulus. Okay. So in lab, you're going to learn about set point and where in a couple systems the set point exists. Okay. So let's look at this diagram right here. Here is a response loop. And response loop has a number of different components to it. In this particular case, we have a stimulus. Number one right here is a stimulus, which is causing an increase in some kind of parameter. That could be temperature, for instance. But in order for your body to be aware of temperature, what does it have to have? It's got to have a sensor, or it's got to have a receptor, like a temperature receptor. You have temperature receptors all over your body, even inside your central nervous system. But you have temperature receptors all over your skin, right? If I took an ice cube, put it on your kneecap, you could tell me what? That's cold. On your back? It's cold. On your neck or ear, wherever, right? You have temperature receptors all over the place. So in a response loop, it started with a stimulus. That stimulus has to be picked up by a sensor. Another name for a sensor is a receptor. You need a receptor for that particular modality of energy. And there's all kinds of different modalities. Temperature is one. pH is another, pressure, light, you have photoreceptors, right? You have hearing receptors. So you need sensors. And that sensor then has to send information to an integration center. And an integration center usually is in our central nervous system someplace. And for instance, if this was blood pressure, the integration center would be in the medulla oblongata because that's where the cardioregulatory center is and vasomotor center that controls your heart and blood vessels. That's in the medulla oblongata. But how does that signal from the receptor get into the central nervous system? What do we call this pathway right here? What do we call this little arrow? What would this arrow be? Peripheral nervous system, that would be a nerve taking signals into the central nervous system. What kind of, you've learned to talk about that kind of pathway. What kind of pathway is that? There's two different words you could use. You could say afferent, and afferent is just a fancy word for sensory, right? So a sensory pafferent is the same thing as an afferent pathway that takes signals from the periphery to the central nervous system. And the integration center is important because that's where the set point exists. So right on your slide, set point right there. So if this was temperature, what would be the set point? You would just have like a 98.6 right here. And if the sensor is monitoring, is measuring a temperature greater than 98.6, the integration center compares it to the set point and says, oh, there's an error. So the integration center then also has to make a decision on what to do. So if your temperature increases, the integration center compares the incoming information with the set point and says, you better start doing what? If your temperature is too high, if there's an arrow, you got to start sweating. So the integration center is going to send signals to the sweat glands right here via what? What kind of pathway is this? This is the efferent pathway or motor pathway to sweat glands. You start sweating, and what's the effect going to be? That's going to decrease your temperature. Notice that the sense of the stimulus and the response are opposite. So this is what kind of feedback loop? Negative, because they're canceling out. Right? So this is a nice mechanism that will maintain homeostasis. So in this particular example, if this was a sweat gland, then that sweat gland is what we would call the effector. Okay, so a response loop has a stimulus, a receptor or sensor, afferent pathway, integration center with set point, okay, sends a decision out through the efferent pathway to an effector, and that will produce a response. And depending on how the response interacts with the stimulus, it's either going to be positive or negative feedback. If the response adds to the stimulus, that's positive feedback leading to a disease state. Okay. Now, let's just go the other way, just to check to see if you have a good feel for what an effector is. Let's just say that there is a decrease in body temperature, and the sensor sent that to the integration center, and the integration center said, oh, your body temperature is too low. I got to make a decision. It's made a decision. I'm not going to tell you what it is. It sends it out this efferent pathway to this effector. What is this effector in this particular circumstance? It's going to be muscle. Instead of a gland, instead of a sweat gland, it's going to be muscle, which is going to contract, and it's going to then increase body temperature, which will subtract from the initial stimulus. Okay? Okay, so that's how to think of response loops. I forget, what time do we stop? Yeah, pretty soon. Okay. Okay, I guess maybe I can talk about this slide, and then we can take a break. And you guys can go to lab. Regulatory mechanism, something called intrinsic control. Intrinsic control is built into the organ that is being regulated. So that organ has the ability to regulate itself. It doesn't need a central nervous system. It doesn't need sweat glands like your whole body to cool down. It can regulate itself. And a real important organ that can regulate itself is the heart. Right, so its contractility, its force of contraction is controlled all by itself to a large degree. And as more blood will flow back to the heart at different rates depending on different circumstances. Okay, and as blood flows back to the heart will fill up more or less degrees. All right, will expand more or not expand quite so much. So if a lot of blood is flowing back to the heart, you think the heart should actually contract more weakly or more strongly as more blood goes back to it? Okay. Okay, as more blood goes back to the heart actually gets stronger, and it can pump that extra blood into the circulatory system. Okay, so that's what we call intrinsic control. And as blood flow to the heart decreases, it gets weaker, and it gets weaker and weaker and weaker. That has some really important clinical implications that we're going to talk about later, okay, in this particular class. But depending on the amount of blood that stretches the heart can either get stronger or it can get weaker as a result of that. So, for instance, when somebody has a hemorrhage, motorcycle accident, and they all of a sudden spill a lot of blood on the pavement, how much blood is going back to the heart? Not very much. Now, this is not a good circumstance, right? Hemorrhage is really, really poor. So there's very little blood going back to the heart. And as a result of that, because intrinsic control of the heart, it gets weaker and weaker and weaker. That's a really bad thing for a patient. So on the way to the hospital, how do we counteract that? We like to increase their blood volume by hooking up what? IV. Even saline increases their blood volume, increases return to the heart, and as the heart expands, it gets stronger and stronger and stronger, and it maintains the life of that patient until they get to the hospital, hopefully. Okay? So that's what we call intrinsic control. As the heart stretches out, it gets stronger under most circumstances, okay, if it's a normal heart. And as it doesn't expand, it gets weaker and weaker and weaker. So that's one intervention that we can do to maintain the strength of somebody's contraction of their heart. That's what we call intrinsic control, because that happens all inside the heart. There's no nerves that are necessary for that. All right, so on Thursday, mark on your PowerPoints where I stopped, and we'll start there again. Okay? Okay. So that's it for today. Let's see if I have my recorder working. Yes, I did.